Okay, good morning.
Oh,
let's see if it's at. Oh, this display is what I want to record. No, let's try that. Good morning. Yeah, now that's recording. Let's see what. Who knows if that's actually working right? But anyway, I've got the audio at least working. I have ambitions today. Let's see if this is actually going to. Hello. I've got that mouse, got that mouse. Oh, that's what was going on. And if... No, that's not what I want. Let's go here. That's not, okay. I'm just trying to play with this technology, and I think I'm going to abandon it. Because right now, it's deciding it doesn't want me to do anything. Well, if I could do anything with my computer, it'd be helpful. Window. Now we've got something. Let's go over here. Okay, so good news is there's now something on my wiki. And if you look here now, you'll see this is here and there's stuff here. Most of these are red links, and they are red links because, well, those pages aren't there. This is mostly mirrored from the mirrored from last winter's class, although I've changed the dates, and I'm potentially good. These are tentative. They're probably going to change in terms of the exact titles, exactly what's covered here. What has also changed now, there's weekly assignments. Last time I did basically every other week. One key thing to know about the assignments is that they're not all going to be programming assignments. My goal right now is to have about half of them be programming assignments, which should be automatically graded, and half of them will be written assignments, which will be more conceptual, which will be closer to being more what's on your tests, you know, what's going in the midterm and the final. The idea being that you need to be able to, of course, prepare for the midterm and final, but the only way you really learn the concepts, I find, is if you actually do the things. So that's what this is. Related to this is I have a... is the class outline here. I'll go through this in a second. Let me make it a little larger. The TAs are now listed. This afternoon I'm figuring out office hours, so that should be updated this afternoon when we're all going to be around. You all should have signed up for one of the tutorials. They start next week, i.e. starting right after class on Monday. Please attend the tutorials. There's 10 of them. They count four. Oh, sorry, that's wrong. I'll fix that, but 20% for the assignments, 20% for the tutorial participation. So each tutorial is worth basically 2% of your grade. So show up to the tutorials. If you miss a tutorial, see a TA in their office hours, show them that you've done the work, and you can get checked off. Related to this, I have an extra credit scheme, which we're going to try again this term, which is, wait, where is it? Course notes. If anyone wants to volunteer to do notes, that can and actually write them up properly. You can get, you know, and add them to the wiki. That gets you 2% extra credit towards your final grade. You can do up to 3 times. Anyone want to sign up for today? Okay. Send me an email afterwards that you've done the notes. And again, I have to assign a TA to actually monitor that with the wiki and stuff. So I'll coordinate with that. So the idea being that sometimes I will do screencasts. I'm trying to do a screencast right now, but I doubt it's working. But at least I always do audio, and so it's nice to have notes to go with that. So again, I went over the outline last time. It's still basically the same outline. The only thing to note is that I split up the page, and now the main web page is again here, and then the notes are here. But the other thing I need to talk about is dates. So we're not going to change this yet. But notice, right now the midterm is set to be Wednesday, February 11th. So if you look at the calendar, Wednesday, February 11th is here. Winter break is the week afterwards, starting on the 16th. So that's the Wednesday before winter break. Given the way the schedule works, I actually have 25 lectures this term, which seems a bit more than before, but I guess that's, I'm not sure exactly how that happened, but anyway, given the structure of things, I have basically 15 lectures after winter break and like would be 12 beforehand. So I'm happy to move the midterm after winter break. But again, I need to know when your other midterms are. So dates for other midterms. Do you know yet? Okay. Figure it out. Yes? Two 404 is happening on March 4th, so that's 2 weeks after winter break. That's pretty late. What? You have two tests. Oh, okay, so that's a second test. Okay. So 2404 is that. Does anyone know about 3004? Two on February 24th. So again, that's the week after winter break. Any other midterms that you know about? Go, yes? 2804 is after the break. So it's sounding like before the break is kind of good. I'm happy to do a before the break one. Well, right now, tentatively, I'll stick with February 11th. On Monday, I will ask again and speak your objections then, or, you know, I don't want to hear anything. Yes? February 13th? Okay, that's Friday. That's, you know, so that's one. I can't completely get away from all of them, but it's, so that seems like, okay, yep, I hear two, mine and one other one. That doesn't sound like a crazy week. That just sounds like sounds okay. Again, I'm happy to potentially switch things. I don't want to do the week right after March, right after winter break. That seems like a bad idea. Because you come back and then, so then it'll be getting into here. Well, I don't know. I'll have to think about that. But on Monday, I'll finalize. Right now, it's on February 11th. If you don't like it, let me know. Otherwise, we'll finalize then. So these are tutorials. It's Monday, Tuesday, Thursday. If you can't go to your assigned tutorial, go to one of the other ones. But I can't make any guarantees because this class is right now full. In fact, it's oversubscribed and people are on a waiting list. So I'm and the size of this class is determined by the tutorial rooms. So I'm expecting that room to be full. So please try to come to your assigned one. If you come to a day where you're not assigned, you might want to bring a laptop. We might be able to squeeze you in a corner or something. Assignments, you'll notice the dates are for Sundays. The idea is lectures for this class are on Monday and Wednesday. I'd normally want to talk about the assignments on Monday, so they are due Sunday at midnight. So the first one is not this coming Sunday, but the Sunday afterwards. That's what it is. You might have thought the dates were wrong. So if you look here, the 11th is this coming Sunday. The 18th is the Sunday afterwards. That's when your first assignment is going to be due. And then after that, every Sunday they should be due. Notice the assignments will be related to the tutorials that previous week. So hopefully you shouldn't need to work over the weekend on these things. But I know a lot of you like to work on the weekends or just end up finding you do. One of the cases, you'll have it at least a week in advance to each assignment. So you'll have at least a week to work on it. Any other basic logistical questions? Okay. So let's move on to actual material. So first thing you should start doing now that you're in this class is, well, first off, if you haven't had any experience with web technologies, you need to go to Code Academy. And in fact, I would say do this week instead of the tutorials. Get going on these lessons. Go through the HTML and CSS, JavaScript, and jQuery ones. These will just give you enough for familiarity. This is not, I mean, can you get away without doing these things? Yes, but it will be harder. Again, this level of material you all should be able to pick up on your own. And then I will then help you with the difficult parts. If you find the stuff that's covered in here difficult, I worry about you in this degree program. It's not, I mean, this is the sort of stuff people do in middle school. You can do this. So just take the time and go through it. Or if you don't like going through interactive lessons, read about it. And you'll find plenty of things to just read a basic thing on, basic primer on JavaScript, HTML, CSS. Get that background. So what I'm going to talk now is about this thing. So if you look in various web browsers, well, in Google Chrome and in Firefox, right now I've got Chrome up. I'll alternate between the browsers because I like both of them for different reasons. But so if you look here under Tools, you'll notice that there is this mode. There's a couple of things here. One is View Source, Developer Tools, JavaScript Console. Let's start with the Developer Tools. Lot of stuff. Sources, timely profiles, resource audits. We're going to be using a lot of these things. You should get in the habit when you surf the web of occasionally going, I wonder what's going on with this page. And getting to look at this because this lets you see what is going on with the web. What's really cool about the web is that the code, at least on the client side, is right in your face. So you can see it. And you can potentially even play with it. Now, it's not the server-side code, and the client-side code for modern websites can be quite intimidating. So let me start with something a little bit simpler. Sorry, what? Yes. I mean, any change, we'll talk about how you make things persistent or how you could actually modify the code in a page in a persistent way. So this is my page. It's a boring page that's been around for a long time in one form or the other. But that means it's very simple. So first off, the thing to know is that there is no JavaScript on this page. So this is old web. So HTML. This is HTML. Tags, you might see, notice this is all parsed and everything. Let's go over here and view source. Where's my tools? View source. So this is the actual page. This is essentially identical to a text file that I edited in my system to update this page periodically. And you can see when I last updated this page was, well, yesterday. Right there. And that's because I typed that in manually. This is very old school. This is the sort of stuff that I'm sure some of you have done, maybe not all of you. But let me just give you a quick little tour of a web page. So one thing to note is that you've got, starts off with this, well, there are these things here, this doc type, HTML, that thing. This is a line that says what kind of document this is. So essentially saying to the web browser, what syntax should I expect this to be in? This has got a really old one. It's old DTD, HTML 401 transitional. Newer pages will just say doc type HTML because that's kind of the newer things. But this, you notice, starts with a bracket exclamation point. Wait, let me make that a little bigger. How about that? Is that easier to see in the back? So this is a comment. It means technically the browser isn't supposed to parse this, although it does kind of look at it with the first line. The real first HTML line is this thing saying it's HTML. So you might go like, wait, it's HTML. Why does it say HTML? Any thoughts? Well, to wrap it, that's true, because the view at the very bottom, you have /HTML. So the basic structure of web pages is this tag thing, where you have tags are entered with angle brackets, you have a start tag, and the corresponding end tag starts with a slash. So here's the head, here's the start of the head, here's the end of the head, just like open braces and closed braces. But these are named. Now, one particular reason you have this HTML is because this syntax does not start with HTML. In fact, this basic kind of syntax of having tags that are open and closed are used by a couple of languages. In fact, the first one to use was this thing called SGML. So SGML, there we go. Good old Standard Generalized Markup Language. This was, so first off, what do we mean by a markup language? By a markup language, we're saying that you have a mix of data and metadata. The data is the actual content you want, and then the metadata is the markup, which is saying something about the data. So it can be as simple, if we're talking about markup here, as, oh, this is a paragraph. This is a heading, H1. This is a link. This is an image. That's what these sort of tags are talking about. But they're metadata, because this is about what it is, and then the actual content is, oh, here, this file. Now, most of your document will be these things that are in, but most of the content that you actually do is between the tags. Like the entire page is between this HTML tags, the header is between this. And you might notice this is a hierarchical representation. It starts, this is very easily represented as a tree, although it's entered in as text. So SGML was originally designed for documents. This was coming that came out of the book industry, the publishing industry. They wanted a way of saying, okay, I want to mark up my book in some general way to say what fonts I should have, what should be the organization, how should I have the end notes, whatever. Tim Berners-Lee, when he created HTML, said, oh, SGML is pretty cool, but it's way too complicated. We need something simpler to make this thing called the World Wide Web. I need a way to annotate text files so that I can encode things like links, and I can include images and other such things. So, but SGML, you could do all that in principle, but you would have had to define a document type, a document type definition, DTD. And that's a big old complicated thing. He wanted to simplify. So he created his own definition for tags, and then he called it HTML for hypertext markup language as opposed to standard generalized markup language. So this thing is saying that, okay, if an HTML-like parser saw this, it sees this. Now, it turns out HTML was too specialized for later on, and SGML was too verbose, so they created something that was kind of in between. That's called XML. So whenever you hear about XML, it's talking about, again, same basic kind of syntax, but instead of there being predefined tags, there's a specification schema associated with an XML document that specifies what the tags mean. So why am I mentioning all this? Is saying that, okay, you're going to look at these HTML documents, you're going to see all these tags, and you won't know exactly what they mean unless you look them up individually. That's perfectly fine. There's a million places on the web where you can find out the meaning of any of these tags. There's only a couple of them, really, that are used with any frequency. I mean, there's other obscure ones, but they aren't used generally so much. But again, you see a tag, look it up. That's what I'm saying. There's not really much to learn about HTML. It's like, okay, you mark it up, you put the Bing tag, end tag. Oh, I want to add a link. Oh, that's the A tag. Oh, I want to add a heading. Oh, it's the H1 tag. Oh, I want to add a paragraph here. Now, of course, the thing you'll notice also with this is that there isn't much in the way of formatting. Like, what does this page actually look like? You know, this, I mean, in terms of the format, this is all saying a heading, paragraph. What about the fonts? What about the background color? What about the things that make it pretty? For a long time, my page did not have anything telling about what it looked like. And then a friend of mine said, I can't stand how your page looks, and gave me something to mark up my page. And so what he gave me was this. So originally with HTML, you just had this page and it would have things like bold and italic, and you try to encode the formatting in the document itself, but it was very, very limited, and the idea, original idea of the web is don't worry about making it pretty, you're supposed to give content. But then, of course, people said, no, I want it pretty. I want to make it look a certain way. They were used to desktop publishing. So they started adding more tags, and they started getting added inline, and they started really messing things up, because now you were adding in information about how the document should look in with your actual content. And it made things extremely messy. So instead, they created something called cascading style sheets. This is a cascading style sheet that's really darn simple. All it's doing is saying, okay, you know, the margins should have, you know, these should be the margins. This should be the normal font. Normal, you know, here, 13 points. You know, this is the preferences of the fonts. Here's a color. Here's the color of the visited links. Here's a cover when you add things. Here, you should put a border around images. Yes? Yes. Style sheets are available on any web page because they have to be. This is why I'm saying that, you know, you can find out how the web works once you just start poking around. Almost every modern website has style sheets, oftentimes multiple style sheets. I'm not showing you those other style sheets right now because, as we will see as we go through this term, they get crazy complicated. This is very simple. So, what's the basic web? The basic web is you have an HTML document that's something like this, and you mix it with a style sheet to make it pretty. Okay, you got a web page. And what's a web server? It's just a program sitting on another computer that gives these files to your web browser when it requests for them. And in fact, it does this recursively, because what you'll first do is when I go here, when I first go to this page, when I specify this, what actually I'm saying is I'm saying http://. That's the actual full URL. Modern web browsers hide the HTTP part. That HTTP part says, connect using the hypertext transfer protocol to get this. Connect to this machine on the internet, people.ses.carlton.ca. And then they ask it for this. That web server happens to be configured that if you ask for tilde soma, it goes in my home directory. I'm user soma on the SES systems. And it says, okay, I need the default page for, you know, that user's web stuff. So I have a public underscore HTML directory. And in that directory, I have a file called index.html, which is this. But it automatically knows that when I just ask for this, for tilde soma, I get index.html. That's all in the configuration of the web server on the SES systems. But so I ask for that file. So it gives me index.html, loads this. That's this source. This is just the parsed version of it. But as part of loading it, it gets in here and it says, oh, link, relative, style sheet, type, CSS, href, anil.css. So it says, load this file too. After you load this page, load this because you're going to need this file in order to fully render it. This tells you the styles. Then it's also got these things of saying, oh, I've got these image tags. The image tag says, now load that file. What? Oh, view source. Oh, I'm viewing view source. That's why. Let's get rid of that. There. But if I wanted to, that's actually the image of it. Now you can tell, oh, it's a JPEG because there's this little magic JFIF. I forget what JFIF stands for, but the idea is there's only a few characters at the beginning of every file that identify the type of the file. And this identifies it as a GIF file, a JPEG file. That's also one of the reasons why you have HTML at the top. That helps identify the type. Okay, we're loading just the byte stream. So there's this thing called the Hypertext Transfer Protocol, which we'll be talking about more, which got us this file. And once this file was loaded, it had other files referred to it, and those all got loaded in the browser, then put them all together and rendered it. So the code that's used to render a web page, the basic web renderer, the engine, you could say, turns out there's only a few current engines that actually render the modern web as you see it. Does anyone know what these are? WebKit, yep. Opera uses Blink now. Trident. So Opera used to have its own engine, and it turned out it was... Sorry, what am I... I'm using the wrong terminology there, and I'll come up with it in a second. But so the basic rendering engine at the heart of different web browsers, even widely different web browsers, come down to these basic engines, if it actually renders the full web. One of them is WebKit. WebKit was originally developed by Apple. It was a fork of the KHTML renderer, which was developed by the KDE project. They forked it and created WebKit, and Apple developed that for their Safari web browser. Google came along, liked it, and incorporated it into Android and incorporated it into Chrome. They then decided they didn't necessarily want to do things exactly like Apple did and forked it. And so they forked it, and that became Blink. This is only the past couple of years they did that. In the meanwhile, there's Firefox, the Mozilla organization. They have their own engine. That's called Gecko. And the other major one is Trident, which is Microsoft's, which is at the heart of Internet Explorer. So I mentioned this because, you know, look at this. This doesn't look so bad to parse, really, programmatically, right? I mean, this is actually, that's one of the beautiful things about HTML. In the early days, HTML seemed like it was this really simple thing. You know, people could create things, you know, web servers were easy to create, web browsers were relatively easy to create. It was all nice and dandy. But now I will tell you, modern rendering engines are beasts. Millions of lines of code. Millions of lines of really ugly code for the most part, because it has to deal with the modern web. And the modern web is broken. Okay, it's also complicated because it turns out there's all kinds of standards now for doing things. This is the dead simple page. This page would render well in like 1996. But since then, we've added all kinds of other technologies, all kinds of ways within this framework for rendering pages. Modern web engines have to understand all of that and also understand all the historical quirks that have happened that, oh, this page was designed for Internet Explorer 6, and Internet Explorer 6 had all kinds of weird bugs and stuff, and so people had all kinds of weird workarounds. And someone came up with a new web browser. Could they fix those bugs? No, because it would break the web page. So have a lot of respect for anyone who works on these rendering engines, because they are scary pieces of technology. They have to be able to deal with malformed things, all kinds of historical baggage. You don't create these if you actually want to make things work, if you want to actually have things look the way they do in regular browsers. The only true specification of what the web is not the technical documents. It's what web browsers do. And the number of people who truly understand that in the world is actually kind of small. So that's why I mentioned that. You're not going to be writing an engine to parse this. Don't even think about it. But what you are going to do is use programs that do. So now I am going to be writing code. You're all going to be working with code that's going to be working with web pages. The reason why we're talking about web applications and not just web pages is because this sort of stuff is not what you create anymore. This sort of stuff is the output of programs that you create. So you create these things programmatically and you manipulate these things programmatically. Whenever you see a web page be dynamic, its layout changes, things appear, things disappear, or something, at a fundamental level, it's changing the HTML. Or actually, more specifically, it is changing the programmatic representation of HTML. Which is some, do you know the name of that? The DOM, the Document Object Model. So what all web browsers do is they take in this sort of HTML document and parse it and turn it into a data structure, which is then available for your use. Specifically, it's available for the web browser's use because it has to be able to know, okay, when this link is clicked, what do I do? And also, it has to have that so that when you run JavaScript, JavaScript can manipulate the page. JavaScript can manipulate the textual representation of the page, but you don't want to do that. You want to be able to access things in a much more higher level way. You want to be able to say, oh, I want to change this image. I want to say something about this paragraph. I want to say something about all paragraphs. You want to be able to talk about the page in a nice higher level way. So you need a way of referring to things. So that's what we have here. You'll notice we have these. Can I increase the font size here? I can. Great. So you'll note that if I do this, I close it. Oh, now it's just a web page. Oh, let me see what's inside that. Oh, there's a head and there's a body. Okay, what's in the header? Oh, here's the header. What's in the body? Oh, here's the header. I've got a headline, a paragraph. See, it's actually easier to read the page when it's parsed because now you can just expand the tags you want. When you look at the text, it's this. Now, for a while with the web, there are these programs that you would use to edit HTML. Things like Dreamweaver was probably the best known of these. But even older versions of the Netscape browser, Netscape Navigator, had a built-in HTML editor. You don't see much in the way of HTML editors anymore. You think, because the cool thing about these things, they would potentially render it at the same time. You could see live views and change it and stuff. We don't do that anymore. You don't use things like Dreamweaver. What do you use instead? Notepad. Well, people do use text editors to edit this, and you know, certainly that's what you use. And you get editors that have nice syntax highlighting and stuff, and you'll use some of them. But, yep. Well, use JavaScript templating engines, but who would use... So the thing to understand is there's a difference between the people who create web... There's content creators and there's web developers. Things like Dreamweaver were actually used by content creators. So people just want to put up a web page. And so you'd use a program like Dreamweaver and you'd see all this mess, which would kind of try to hide from you, but you'd have to deal with it. And you'd sit there and you'd have a web designer. They'd try to make it all pretty. They try to lay it out. It'd be almost like doing something in a word processor. It's like, oh, let me change the size of this page and of this heading. Let me change the font or let me change the layout and everything. And we don't do that anymore. What we instead have are content management systems of various kinds. You might have heard things like WordPress. Oh, come on. How long can it take to load the WordPress site? There we go. Okay. You probably have heard of things like WordPress. Might have heard of things like Drupal or Joomla. There's all these content management systems. And they take the idea of separating HTML HTML had this idea of separating the markup from the actual content. And they thought, oh, well, you just have to edit these tags, and then you maybe have a separate style sheet that would say how it's actually formatted. You can just edit HTML. It's all easy. Content manager systems go take that to its logical extreme. What I've got is, like, for example, my wiki. What can I do with my wiki? Okay, this is all this markup of things. What do I actually enter? Oh, well, let me log in. So I'm logged in now. It's like, oh, let me edit this. Oh, I want to say edit. I can just edit it. I just type it in here. I can make a change. I'm not going to make a change right now. Actually, I can. But no, that this is how I've created this page. I did not edit HTML to create this web page. Well, that's not strictly true. There was kind of some HTML when I put this table together, because there's this. I do have some table tags. So this is kind of ugly. I generally don't edit this directly in the wiki. I edit it, you know, in a text editor and then paste it in. But most of the stuff, unless you're actually trying to do a slightly fancier thing, and actually there's a way of doing tables in the markup language of MediaWiki. So by the way, this is the program that's doing this is something called MediaWiki. MediaWiki, the formatting of this should look pretty familiar because, of course, this is the same code that's used to power Wikipedia. This is not Wikipedia. This is my own hosted thing, but it's using the same basic code as Wikipedia does. And they developed this wiki so that people can do things like create articles on snails and not have to think about how it's going to be formatted. They just enter in the content. And then if the folks developing the wiki decide, oh, we're going to change around the style, we're going to make it look prettier, we're going to change how the links are and stuff, they just change it. And everything gets updated. And you can also have cool features. Things like, let's go to the course outline. Now, you might say, you know, I'd really like to print this out for some reason. I know some of you actually like printing things out, having things on paper. I know, kind of old-fashioned. So you might say, download as PDF. There it is. This is the joy of markup. Did I make it look like this? No. Did I specify this formatting? No. I just specified what were headings and other things. And it doesn't look too bad, does it? Even the links are there at the end. It puts a little footnote, you know, little footnotes there, the end notes. That's the beauty of markup. You specify what it's supposed to be in one way, and then you can generate in lots of different outputs. So getting back, the old web was this thing that you edited these source pages. The new web is, if I'm going to generate content, I pick the program I want to enter the content into. Maybe someone else has already set up the website with me. They've already chosen the program, configured it and everything. Or if I want to do my own, I configure my own instance. You know, I want to put up my own website. If people say, I want to do a website, what should I do? Say, get WordPress. Use WordPress. Put your content there, pick a theme that's pretty that you like, you're done. Most websites that most people do can be handled by something like WordPress. Small e-commerce sites even. Are there other ones? Yes, but WordPress is pretty easy to do. So you pick the program, you enter your content there. That's not what we're learning in this class. You're not learning how to use WordPress. You're learning how to build the technology behind WordPress. How does it do it? And the key thing to understand about something like WordPress is that there are people who know a lot about HTML and know a lot about CSS that work in something like WordPress. They're not the programmers. They're the web designers. People who actually are interested in the more artistic side of things. That's not what this class is about. That's not me. Some of you actually have those interests, have those skills. That's great. If you can combine that with the programming, it makes it's actually a really nice combination. Because then you can do things like create themes. you can change the way these applications look and feel and work, because not only are you working on the aesthetic side, you also can implement it in code. But what we're really concerned with in this class is, how do we provide the framework? How do we provide the technology for someone building a website, for someone creating something like WordPress? How would you implement your own WordPress? What would it take? You may say, don't build something as general as WordPress, but you might want to build an application for some other specialized purpose. And when you do, or you might end up modifying or extending one. Then you might say, well, why do I want to create a website? Well, it turns out nowadays you don't just want to create a website, you want to create a program. And when you create a program, you're using web technologies. Almost any program nowadays is going to use this in one way or the other, as we'll discuss. So I promised breaks. We're at about 45 minutes in. So I'm going to pause for 5 minutes here, and then we will talk about JavaScript. Okay, let's go ahead and get started again. Okay. So we've talked about HTML. We've talked about CSS a bit. Kind of talked about this whole web server thing. Now there's two other pieces we need to talk about. One is HTTP. The other is JavaScript. So first, a bit about HTTP. So HTTP is a network protocol for sending these files around and sending, you know, web data around. So we have to send requests to the server to get content, and then we get a response back. So to understand what's happening here, we can see this network tab tells us what's happening. So what you see is, oh, here's the file that we requested. Then we have this column called method. And then it says a status. It says a type. It says who initiated, size, time, and this tells you when things happen. So the idea of this is, at first, we ask for the initial page. How did we ask for the initial page? We did a GET request. Turns out most of the content you access on the web is done via the GET method of HTTP. HTTP is a very simple protocol. It only has two main operations, GET and POST. GET is to get pages. POST is to change the state of the web server in some way. Normally, POSTs are used for forms. So whenever you enter in your username and password, or whenever you go to an e-commerce site and like type in your credit card information or something, that's going via a POST. So this is saying that this was gotten via GET, and this had a status. So what you'll see is these, you'll see the 200 code is the most common. What that means is the page came through okay. That's the return value of the GET request. This is how the browser knows whether it succeeded. 304 says not modified means that it already had a copy of it when I loaded it. It was cached. So basically, the timestamp and everything on the version of the page that the server had is the same as the web browser had locally. So it didn't send it over again. It just checked that. So that's part of the thing that HTTP allows you to do, is allows you to negotiate. Well, I have this page. Do you already have this? You already have it? Okay, I won't send it to you. So that's a 304 message. There's one code that you all probably have seen many times in your lives when surfing the web. 404. Page not found. That's what it is. You did a GET request. The web server replied with a 404. And oftentimes a 404 code will have a page associated with it, with a special error page. But the browser knows that the page was not properly retrieved because of the 404 error. And so why is that important for the browser to know, so it doesn't do things like cache the content? So you might be looking at this and saying, oh, can I do anything with this? So you can do all these things like saying copy the request headers, copy response headers, copy response. Your browser has to say, this lets you manipulate what's happening here. This is the sources, this is the elements. What I really, that's not what I want. So, here we go. That's what I want. Yeah, the network. So when you do this, there's another look here. What we were looking was at this timing, preview, headers. So what this is saying is, this is the information that your browser sent to the server. This is what came back from it in terms of a status code. These are the other headers that were sent. And these are the response headers. So you want to see the full response. This is the full response. This is the content that you got back. But here in the headers, you can see the response headers. So what am I saying by headers and content? What I'm saying is that the content's what you actually want. The headers is metadata about it. It's information about what you want. So this is saying what I want to ask for. It's saying, I'm going to talk to this IP address. 134.117.29.41. So what does that correspond to? What is that number? Server. Which server? This is people.scs.carlton.ca. When you're connecting to people.scs.carlton.ca, you're doing a DNS request. That DNS request, the domain name system, is a distributed database that associates domain names with IP addresses. When you register a domain name, what you're doing is you're getting an entry in the database which can point to an arbitrary IP address. Well, actually, what you're building, like if you register a domain, you would do things like register scs.carlton.ca, and then you would just have various hosts in it, like people. I have my own domain, and then I can define, when you get your own domain, then you can define subdomains or hosts within it. But note that the internet, strictly speaking, does not need this to operate. The internet is based upon the internet protocol, which is specified by IP addresses. So that means that every computer connected to the internet has a number associated with it to talk to it. This in particular is an IPv4 address, which means it's only 32 bits, written in decimal notation. So this is 8 bits, this is 8 bits, this is 8 bits, this is 8 bits, 32 bits. You might have heard of something called IPv6. IPv6 is basically IPv4 with a few modifications, but the big modification is the IP addresses are bigger. Instead of being 32 bits, they're 128 bits. The idea being 32 bits is only 4 billion. We're running out of IP addresses. You imagine when they first created the Internet Protocol back in the early 70s, they thought, oh, that's plenty. Nope. So we have 128 bits. That should last us till the age of the universe. So, unless we do really stupid things. But 128 bits is a lot of bits. But the internet, particularly in North America, still works on IPv4, so most of the time this is what you see. So, we're connecting to this machine. This domain name is being translated to this IPv4 address. And then we have this thing here, this 80. So that's the IP address. And then what's this? That's the port. So this specifies what computer I'm talking to. The port specifies which program I'm talking to on that computer. There's lots and lots of programs that run on a modern computer. You have to talk to a specific one. A lot of the ports, every time you make a network connection, a port is allocated. So whenever this computer was talking to this web server, it was allocating a port. But the ports are normally higher number of ports, things above 1024. If you see a port that's below 1024, it's a well-known port, which means it's a port corresponding to a service that has been defined by the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, IANA, I think. I forget which organizations do what nowadays. But the idea is that certain numbers are associated with certain kinds of network protocols. So, for example, if you do secure shell, SSH, to a system, by default, it connects on port 22, because 22 is the SSH port. If you send email, that's using the simple mail transfer protocol, SMTP. That is on port 25. DNS is on UDP port 53, I think. Might be wrong about that. But the web is port 80. That is the default port of the web. Most of the time. There's one other major port associated with the web. 443. You know what 443 stands for? Let's go to... Okay, now we got HTTPS. Secure HTTP. So standard HTTP is not encrypted. Goes completely in plain text. Anyone listening on the wire and anywhere between the source and the destination can see exactly what you sent and received. HTTPS is a secure protocol. It's far from perfect. There's lots of ways of breaking it, but to a first approximation, it's pretty good, which means that the protocol is encrypted. So let's look at the developer things. Let's look at this. Let's reload this page. So we can see the stuff here. Oh, we got lots of requests here. But we can see at least this one. And then we can see that the request went to 184.86.39.83:443 because it was doing HTTPS. Yes? The port is encoded with this. When it says HTTPS, it's HTTPS. You don't check the port. In fact, what you actually want to check if it's secure is you want to check the certificate associated with it. So when you see these little lock icons and you click on them, this tells you where it came from. Identity verified. What the heck does that mean, identity verified? The identity of this website has been verified by VeriSign. Your connection's here. Site information, certificate information. Oh, it's associated with this. Details, yours is. If you want to know what it's secure or not, you look at this sort of stuff. I'm not going to talk about this today. But whenever anyone says something is secure, something is only secure with respect to certain assumptions. The basic assumption is that easyweb.td.com is the right place to go for your website. Anyway, let's see something. Let's try a U.S. bank. Yeah, there we go. So you'll notice, I'm actually surprised, TD on that website did not have a fancy new certificate. There's this new thing called extended validation certificates, EV certificates. So you notice now, instead of saying HTTPS, what did it say? It says Citigroup Inc., US. This is a newer thing for secure websites. So if you want to have a website that actually is really doing things, it should say something like, oh, the name of the organization here. I wonder if Amazon does that. Let's see, Amazon CA. Regular Amazon does not do that, but here, no, it doesn't. Limited uptake, such as the nature of standards. So this is the thing we get into web. There's this standard, there's this standard, there's this detail, there's this detail. The thing you should see, though, is that, oh, look, bunches of gets. Oh, look, bunches of status 200s. Where did it all start? It started with, at the very top, with welcome. Welcome.c, that's really odd, but I guess that's the page that we ended up on. Okay, welcome.c, and then that was other, and then all these. So you notice the other means I typed it in. And then all these saying at line 73 in welcome.c, it asked for amw.js. Oh, that's a JavaScript file. Then it asked for this, another JavaScript file. Oh, here's another JavaScript file. Oh, here's a CSS file. Oh, here's another CSS file. Oh, here's another JS. Oh, here's some images. And look, it just keeps going. That's the modern web. Pages are complicated. There's lots of stuff going on. But with any one of them, what's happening is pretty straightforward. You're doing an HTTP GET request. As part of the HTTP GET request, you include certain headers. Specifically, you specify, well, you do a GET of this URL, and then you send, this is the text you send. Say, GET US welcome.c HTTP 1.1. Host online to citibank.com. Okay, connection keep alive. Accept. We'll take text HTML. We'll take app. We have this. We'll take this. We'll take this. We'll take this. User agent.
Are things like user agent, your IP address, like an automatic variable for JavaScript?
Everything in the headers, I think, is part of the DOM. I think you can look at the headers. You don't normally do it, but I think they're there. Yeah, you can. Yeah, you can check the headers from JavaScript. Anyone know what this user agent string means? What is your browser? So what we said to the Citibank website was we said, oh, I want to get this web page. And I'm saying keep the connection alive means don't just shut it down. I'm going to have to get more stuff. So keep the TCP connections, the network connection open so I can send more data because I'm going to send lots of gets. Because, yeah, you saw all those pages that came up. And then saying, oh, I'm willing to accept these kinds of formats. And then this is who I am. Notice this is Chrome. This is Chrome. What's the first thing it says? Mozilla/5.0. What's Mozilla associated with? Anyone know? Firefox. That Mozilla was the original name of Netscape Navigator. We're talking things from like 1995. Netscape Navigator. That's still there because websites expect it to be there as the user agent. They say, oh, if it's a desktop browser, you say you're Mozilla 5.0, and then you say in parentheses what you really are. Oh, I'm running Windows NT 6.1. Windows NT 6.1? What's that? Oh, it turns out that's actually the real name of Windows 7. Because when people say, oh, there's Windows 2000, there's Windows XP, and there's other things, they're all Windows NT. There was the Windows 90, there was the old Windows 3.1, Windows 95, and then there was Windows NT, and it's still Windows NT, as far as programs are concerned. Marketing people, they say other things. Wow, 64-bit. Woohoo! And then Apple WebKit. Apple. What's Apple in there? This is Chrome. This is Google there. Oh, they expect this thing because, oh, yeah, people know about WebKit, so we'll tell them we're WebKit. And then it says, oh, why is it Apple WebKit? Oh, Apple WebKit's like KHTML. Remember I said KHTML? WebKit was based on KHTML? Okay, there it is. Like Gecko, which is Mozilla's rendering engine. See, we act like that. Oh, but this is what we actually are. Chrome this. But Chrome is kind of like Safari. You have a whole history of web browsers in this one line. This is the nature of the web. Everyone kind of saying, okay, you know, you showed a different web browsers. Different web browsers know about different you're talking to the web server. Different web servers know about different kinds of web browsers. And they'll actually specialize the content to different kinds of web browsers. Because they go like, oh, you're this kind of web browser? Oh, I better send you a special version of that page because otherwise it's going to break. So they try to be all smart about it. And so web browsers, as they've evolved, have to keep saying, well, okay, I'm this, but I'm really this, but I'm really like this. I'm really like this too. So send me whatever. Mm-hmm. What's the what? It's a version. It's a Safari build. They're saying they're like that Safari build, which might not be like the current Safari build, but okay, you know, it's like the Safari build. This gives you an idea of the level of hacks that the web is built upon. When you see a string that's crazy like this, you realize, uh-oh. Forget the specs. You do experimentation to figure out what the heck's happening there. But again, so we have all these contents. Oh, look, cookie. We'll explain cookies later. But, oh, there's the cookie. And then this is what it sent back. So it said back, no cache. don't remember this web page. Don't save it. Send it again if you ask for it. Why? Because it's a banking website and they don't like you caching banking websites. Must revalidate. Please check again. Proxy. If you're a proxy, you got to revalidate. Don't store it. All these new caching. Keep out the connection. Okay, we'll keep it alive. Here's the content. Here's the type. Here's the character set encoding of it. Here's the date. Oh, you can hold the page till this long. Oh, expires when? Expires in 1970. So I guess means it's expired already. Don't load. Here's some other things. Oh, you know what P3P is? Privacy policies. They have a privacy policy, P3P. You look at that XML and see what they're proving there. But, God, I don't know that stuff. There's a lot of headers. There's a lot of details. This is saying a lot about how the negotiation of content between the web server and the web client. You're not going to understand all these headers. No one probably understands all the details of all these headers because there's all kinds of weird historical baggage that's there. So, such is life. But, so most of the time, will you be looking at these headers? No. You'll look at the basic thing. Okay, it's a get. Okay, what was the response header? Okay, fine. And maybe you'll start looking at the cookies. Okay? So, to round out things, now let's talk about JavaScript. Because this class is about programming, right? So where's that programming language? How do I do that programming? Well, one cool thing about JavaScript is we don't have a compiler. Now, that's not to say that compilation doesn't happen. It turns out modern JavaScript in a modern browser like Chrome or Firefox runs really fast. Like, very close to C, sometimes faster than C fast. You may go like, wait, what? Well, there's this technology called just-in-time compilation, which basically means when you first run the code, it interprets it or does a really quick compilation that's going to produce inefficient code. And then if you run it more iterations, do you think it optimizes it on the fly, making it faster and faster so that it will run basically like at machine code speeds. JavaScript is modern JavaScript is quite fast. But it is also a very dynamic language. So you'll notice in your web browser, when you go into develop mode, there is this console window. This console window does one thing. It shows errors. Capture events is deprecated. This method doesn't do anything. Resource interpreted as image, but transfer with MIME type text JavaScript. The sad thing about the web is almost on most pages you visit, if you look in the console, you'll see warnings or errors. You know, think normally when you compile code, you run code, you expect it to run without errors. No, that's actually not the case. You may go like, wait, why don't they get rid of those errors? It turns out some of the things that generate errors in Chrome are exactly what's needed for another web browser to work properly. It's a quirk. It just generates an error here. Okay, Chrome just ignores it. The other browser needs it to work. So, again, part of the brokenness of the web. But this is more than just a log. This is a log of all the errors that were generated by the page, but it's also interactive. Now you might go like, okay, great, I can add two numbers. Really exciting. But I can also do things like x equals 5. And I can type x. I can assign variables. Turns out this is a full JavaScript interpreter. This is something known as a read eval print loop, which means it reads something you type in, it evaluates it, does something with it, and then prints the output. This kind of interaction with a programming language is not something you've done a lot up till now, but it's a very classic way of dealing with things. It's kind of like your shells. When you type in a command line for Unix, you type in a shell, you're typing in the bash programming language or T shell or whatever, you type in something, it evaluates it, maybe runs some other programs, and then returns a response. That's exactly what this is here, except it's for JavaScript. Remember I talked about JavaScript is Lisp in C syntax? What was the first read eval print loop? Lisp. legacy right here. So you might go like, well, why is this useful? Well, I can run any JavaScript I want in the context of this web page. I can manipulate anything in this web page and do what I want. So, like, for example, if I start looking at the sources, okay, we're almost out of time here. So let's try to see, there's all these, it's a lot of stuff. Okay. So, like, for example, you see all this code here? Ooh, God, it's minified. So let's see, there's a function there, function D. So I should be able to do things like D. Oh, D is 25. What's E? Oh, there's completions. Oh, look, these are all things that are defined in here. Ooh. All the code's there. I can see it. I can even redefine it. So if you're curious what's happening with the web page, it's all there. Now, will you understand how the Citibank web page is working right now? No. You're not, because it's a complicated program and you only have half of it. But this is the sort of stuff we'll be playing with in the semester. So to wrap up, go home, bring up the developer console in your favorite browser, look at it, and go to Code Academy and do the basic lessons. You'll be much happier.